Hello and thank you for tuning into Bricotta Circle, your tribe of storytellers for nonprofit organizations. We're broadcasting on Party 93.4. Bricotta is a word in the Filipino language that means best friends. Bricotta Circle is a community of artists who are passionate about helping nonprofit organizations tell their stories in more compelling ways to engage people into becoming active supporters, volunteers, and donors who want to create real positive impact in their communities. I'm Panangara, your main mixologist for Bricotta Circle. You can check out my blog on BricottaCircle.com, where I talk about storytelling for nonprofits, fundraising, and how to grow your organization's impact and value for the community. Value is intrinsic to the culture of an organization, and it is the role of a leader to help its members find meaning in what is valued. A great leader articulates the organization's vision in ways that build confidence within the people who are charged with executing the mission every single day. Story is the best vehicle for illustrating and stewarding this vision so that people can forge deeper meaning in their work. So what makes a great leader? Management theorist Simon Sinek suggests it's someone who makes their employees feel secure, who draws staffers into a circle of trust. But creating trust and safety, especially in an uneven economy, means taking on big responsibility. Fascinated by the leaders who make impact in the world, Simon Sinek has discovered some remarkable patterns in how they think, act, and communicate. He wrote the book Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action, in order to explore his idea of the golden circle, what he calls a naturally occurring pattern grounded in the biology of human decision-making that explains why we are inspired by some people, leaders, messages, and organizations over others. He explores circles of safety, exploring how to enhance feelings of trust and confidence in making bold decisions. It's the subject of his book entitled Leaders Eat Last. Let's listen to Simon Sinek.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features leadership expert Simon Sinek. This talk contains powerful visuals. Download the video at TED.com. Here's Simon Sinek.
There's a man by the name of Captain William Swenson who recently was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions on September 8th, 2009. On that day, a column of American and Afghan troops were making their way through a part of Afghanistan to help protect a group of government officials, a group of Afghan government officials who'd be meeting with some local village elders. The column came under ambush and was surrounded on three sides. And amongst many other things, Captain Swenson was recognized for running into live fire to rescue the wounded and pull out the dead. One of the people he rescued was a sergeant, and he and a comrade were making their way to a medevac helicopter. And what was remarkable about this day is by sheer coincidence, one of the medevac medics happened to have a GoPro camera on his helmet and captured the whole scene on camera. It shows Captain Swenson and his comrade bringing this wounded soldier who'd received a gunshot to the neck. They put him in the helicopter, and then you see Captain Swenson bend over and give him a kiss before he turns around to rescue more. I saw this, and I thought to myself, where do people like that come from? What is that? That is some deep, deep emotion when you would want to do that. There's a love there. And I want to know, why is it that I don't have people that I work with like that? You know, in the military, they give medals to people who are willing to sacrifice themselves so that others may gain. In business, we give bonuses to people who are willing to sacrifice others so that we may gain. Yeah, back. Right? So I asked myself, where do people like this come from? And my initial conclusion was that they're just better people. That's why they're attracted to the military. These better people are attracted to this concept of service. But that's completely wrong. What I learned is that it's the environment. And if you get the environment right, every single one of us has the capacity to do these remarkable things. And more importantly, others have that capacity too. I've had the great honor of getting to meet some of these who we would call heroes, who've put themselves and put their lives at risk to save others. And I asked them, why would you do it? Why did you do it? And they all say the same thing, because they would have done it for me. It's this deep sense of trust and cooperation. So trust and cooperation are really important here. The problem with concepts of trust and cooperation is that they are feelings. They're not instructions. I can't simply say to you, trust me, and you will. I can't simply instruct two people to cooperate and they will. It's not how it works. It's a feeling. So where does that feeling come from? If you go back 50,000 years to the Paleolithic era, to the early days of Homo sapien, what we find is that the world was filled with danger. All of these forces working very, very hard to kill us. Nothing personal. Whether it was the weather, lack of resources, maybe a saber-toothed tiger, all of these things working to reduce our lifespan. And so we evolved into social animals, where we live together and work together in what I call a circle of safety, inside the tribe, where we felt like we belong. And when we felt safe amongst our own, the natural reaction was trust and cooperation. There are inherent benefits to this. It means I can fall asleep at night and trust that someone from within my tribe will watch for danger. If we don't trust each other, if I don't trust you, that means you won't watch for danger. Bad system of survival. The modern day is exactly the same thing. The world is filled with danger, things that are trying to frustrate our lives or reduce our success, reduce our opportunity for success. It could be the ups and downs of an economy, the uncertainty of the stock market. It could be a new technology that renders your business model obsolete overnight. Or it could be your competition that is sometimes trying to kill you. It's sometimes trying to put you out of business, but at the very minimum, is working hard to frustrate your growth and steal your business from you. We have no control over these forces. These are a constant, and they're not going away. The only variable are the conditions inside the organization. And that's where leadership matters, because it's the leader that sets the tone. When a leader makes the choice to put the safety and lives of the people inside the organization first, to sacrifice their comforts and sacrifice the tangible results so that the people remain and feel safe and feel like they belong, remarkable things happen. I was flying on a trip, and I was witness to an incident where a passenger attempted to board before their number was called. And I watched the gate agent treat this man like he had broken the law, like a criminal. He was yelled at for attempting to board one group too soon. So I said something. I said, why do you have to treat us like cattle? Why can't you treat us like human beings? And this is exactly what she said to me. She said, sir, if I don't follow the rules, I could get in trouble or lose my job. All she was telling me is that she doesn't feel safe. All she was telling me is that she doesn't trust her leaders. The reason we like flying Southwest Airlines is not because they necessarily hire better people, it's because they don't fear their leaders. You see, if the conditions are wrong, we are forced to expend our own time and energy to protect ourselves from each other. And that inherently weakens the organization. When we feel safe inside the organization, we will naturally combine our talents and our strengths and work tirelessly to face the dangers outside and seize the opportunities. The closest analogy I can give to what a great leader is like being a parent. If you think about what being a great parent is, what do you want? What makes a great parent? We want to give our child opportunities, education, discipline them when necessary, all so that they can grow up and achieve more than we could for ourselves. Great leaders want exactly the same thing. They want to provide their people opportunity, education, discipline when necessary, build their self-confidence, give them the opportunity to try and fail, all so that they could achieve more than we could ever imagine for ourselves. Charlie Kim, who's the CEO of a company called NextJump in New York City, a tech company, he makes the point that if you had hard times in your family, would you ever consider laying off one of your children? We would never do it. Then why do we consider laying off people inside our organization? Charlie implemented a policy of lifetime employment. If you get a job at NextJump, you cannot get fired for performance issues. In fact, if you have issues, they will coach you and they will give you support, just like we would with one of our children who happens to come home with a C from school. It's the complete opposite. This is the reason so many people have such a visceral hatred, anger at some of these banking CEOs with their disproportionate salaries and bonus structures. It's not the numbers. It's that they have violated the very definition of leadership. They have violated this deep-seated social contract. We know that they allowed their people to be sacrificed so that they could protect their own interests. Or worse, they sacrificed their people to protect their own interests. This is what so offends us, not the numbers. Would anybody be offended if we gave a $150 million bonus to Gandhi? How about a $250 million bonus to Mother Teresa? Do we have an issue with that? None at all. None at all. Great leaders would never sacrifice the people to save the numbers. They would sooner sacrifice the numbers to save the people. Bob Chapman, who runs a large manufacturing company in the Midwest called Barry Waymiller, in 2008, was hit very hard by the recession, and they lost 30% of their orders overnight. Now, in a large manufacturing company, this is a big deal, and they could no longer afford their labor pool. They needed to save $10 million. So, like so many companies today, the board got together and discussed layoffs. And Bob refused. You see, Bob doesn't believe in head counts. Bob believes in heart counts. And it's much more difficult to simply reduce the heart count. And so they came up with a furlough program. Every employee from secretary to CEO was required to take 4 weeks of unpaid vacation. They could take it any time they wanted, and they did not have to take it consecutively. But it was how Bob announced the program that mattered so much. He said, "It's better that we should all suffer a little than any of us should have to suffer a lot." And morale went up. They saved $20 million. And most importantly, as would be expected, when the people feel safe and protected by the leadership in the organization, the natural reaction is to trust and cooperate. And quite spontaneously, nobody expected, people started trading with each other. Those who could afford it more would trade with those who could afford it less. People would take 5 weeks so that somebody else only had to take 3. Leadership is a choice. It is not a rank. I know many people at the senior-most levels of organizations who are absolutely not leaders. They are authorities. And we do what they say because they have authority over us, but we would not follow them. And I know many people who are at the bottoms of organizations, who have no authority, and they are absolutely leaders. And this is because they have chosen to look after the person to the left of them, and they have chosen to look after the person to the right of them. This is what a leader is. I heard a story of some Marines who were out in theater, and as is the Marine custom, the officer ate last, and he let his men eat first. And when they were done, there was no food left for him. And when they went back out in the field, his men brought him some of their food so that he may eat. Because that's what happens. We call them leaders because they go first. We call them leaders because they take the risk before anybody else does. We call them leaders because they will choose to sacrifice so that their people may be safe and protected and so their people may gain. And when we do, the natural response is that our people will sacrifice for us. They will give us their blood and sweat and tears to see that their leader's vision comes to life. And when we ask them, why would you do that? Why would you give your blood and sweat and tears for that person? They all say the same thing. Because they would have done it for me. And isn't that the organization we would all like to work in? Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Simon Sinek, recorded at TED in March of 2014. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4.
you walk with me, my sweet love. When I see the light in your eyes, I realize I finally found my way home. Walk with me, together we can find ground. Won't you walk with me? Take my hand, together we can lift the veil. Take my hand, my sweet love. When I see the light in your eyes, I realize I finally found
And that was Hawk with their song, Walk With Me. We are Barcata Circle on Party93.4. You can follow us on Twitter.com/Party93.4 and Facebook.com/Party93.4. Leadership with storytelling at its core builds a stronger organization. Stories cut through the clutter and engage people on a human level. Leaders who promote a culture of storytelling help team members form a deeper emotional relationship with a mission and with each other. Fields Wicker Murin wants to improve the quality and impact of leadership worldwide by discovering leaders in unique local settings and connecting them with one another. She is co-founder of Leaders Quest, an organization that brings together leaders from around the world to learn about key trends in their regions and to explore their role as leaders. Through regional quests, leaders learn how their efforts are interconnected and have the potential to improve the world at the global level, too. Leaders Quest is cross-cultural, interdisciplinary, and multi-generational. We know that leadership doesn't have a user's manual, but Fields Wicker Murin says stories of remarkable local leaders are the next best thing. At a TED Salon in London, she shares three. Let's listen to Fields Wicker Murin.
This TED Talk was recorded live at TED Salon in London. This episode features leadership specialist Fields Wicker Murin. Here's Fields Wicker Murin.
I'm going to talk about some of my discoveries around the world through my work. These are not discoveries of planets or new technologies or science. They're discoveries of people and the way people are and new leadership. This is Benki. Benki is a leader of the Ashaninka Nation. His people live in Brazil and in Peru. Benki comes from a village so remote up in the Amazon that to get there, either you have to fly and land on water or go by canoe for several days. I met Benki 3 years ago in São Paulo when I'd brought him and other leaders from indigenous peoples to meet with me and leaders from around the world because we wanted to learn from each other. We wanted to share our stories with each other. The Ashaninka people are known throughout South America for their dignity, their spirit, and their resistance, starting with the Incas and continuing through the 19th century with the rubber tappers. Today's biggest threat to the Ashaninka people and to Benki comes from illegal logging, the people who come into the beautiful forest and cut down ancient mahogany trees, float them down the river to rolled markets. Benki knew this. He could see what was happening to his forest, to his environment, because he was taken under his grandfather's wing when he was only 2 years old to begin to learn about the forest and the way of life of his people. His grandfather died when he was only 10. And at that young age, 10 years old, Benki became the padre of his community. Now, in the Ashaninka tradition and culture, the padre is the most important person in the community. This is the person who contains within him all the knowledge, all the wisdom of centuries and centuries of life. And not just about his people, but about everything that his people's survival depended on. The trees, the birds, the water, the soil, the forest. So when he was only 10, and he became the padre, he began to lead his people. He began to talk to them about the forest that they needed to protect, the way of life they needed to nurture. He explained to them that it was not a question of survival of the fittest. It was a question of understanding what they needed to survive and to protect that. 8 years later, when he was a young man of 18, Benki left the forest for the first time. He went 3,000 miles on an odyssey to Rio, to the Earth Summit, to tell the world what was happening in his tiny little corner. And he went because he hoped the world would listen. Some did, not everybody. But if you can imagine this young man with his headdress and his flowing robe, learning a new language, Portuguese, not to mention English, going to Rio, building a bridge to reach out to people he'd never met before, a pretty hostile world. But he wasn't dismayed. Benki came back to his village full of ideas, new technologies, new research, new ways of understanding what was going on. Since that time, he's continued to work with his people, and not only the Ashaninka Nation, but all the peoples of the Amazon and beyond. He's built schools to teach children to care for the forest. Together, he's led the reforestation of over 25% of the land that had been destroyed by the loggers. He's created a cooperative to help people diversify their livelihoods, and he's brought the internet and satellite technology to the forest, both so the people themselves could monitor the deforestation, but also so that they could speak from the forest to the rest of the world. If you were to meet Benki and ask him, why are you doing this? Why are you putting yourself at risk? Why are you making yourself vulnerable to what is often a hostile world? He would tell you, as he told me, I asked myself, he said, what did my grandparents and my great-grandparents do to protect the forest for me? And what am I doing? So when I think of that, I wonder what our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, when they ask themselves that question, I wonder how they will answer. For me, the world is veering towards a future we don't much want when we really think about it deep inside. It's a future we don't know the details of, but it's a future that has signs, just like Benki saw the signs around him. We know we are running out of what we need. We're running out of fresh water. We're running out of fossil fuels. We're running out of land. We know climate change is going to affect all of us. We don't know how, but we know it will. And we know that there will be more of us than ever before, 5 times as many people in 40 years than 60 years ago. We are running out of what we need. And we also know that the world has changed in other ways, that since 1960, there are 1/3 as many new countries that exist as independent entities on the planet. Egos, systems of government, figuring it out, massive change. And in addition to that, we know that 5 other really big countries are going to have a say in the future, a say we haven't even really started to hear yet. China, India, Russia, South Africa, and Benki's own Brazil, where Benki got his civil rights only in the 1988 Constitution. But you know all that. You know more than Benki knew when he left his forest and went 3,000 miles. You also know that we can't just keep doing what we've always done, because we'll get the results we've always gotten. And this reminds me of something I understand Lord Salisbury said to Queen Victoria over 100 years ago when she was pressing him, please change. He said, change? Why change? Things are bad enough as they are. We have to change. It's imperative to me when I look around the world that we need to change ourselves. We need new models of what it means to be a leader. We need new models of being a leader and a human in the world. I started life as a banker. Now, I don't admit to that to anybody but my very close friends. But for the past 8 years, I've done something completely different. My work has taken me around the world, where I've had the real privilege of meeting people like Benki and many others who are making change happen in their communities. People who see the world differently, who are asking different questions, who have different answers, who understand the filters that they wear when they go out into the world. This is Sanghamitra. Sanghamitra comes from Bangalore. I met Sanghamitra 8 years ago when I was in Bangalore organizing a workshop with leaders of different NGOs working on some of the hardest aspects of society. Sanghamitra didn't start life as a leader of an NGO. She started her career as a university professor, teaching English literature. But she realized that she was much too detached from the world doing that. She loved it, but she was too detached. And so in 1993, a long time ago, she decided to start a new organization called Samraksha, focused on one of the hardest areas, one of the hardest issues in India, anywhere in the world at the time, HIV/AIDS. Since that time, Samraksha has grown from strength to strength and is now one of the leading health NGOs in India. But if you just think about the state of the world and knowledge of HIV/AIDS in 1993, in India at that time, it was skyrocketing and nobody understood why. And everyone was actually very, very afraid. Today, there are still 3 million HIV-positive people in India. That's the second largest population in the world. When I asked Sanghamitra, how did you get from English literature to HIV/AIDS? Not an obvious path. She said to me, it's all connected. Literature makes one sensitive to people, to their dreams, and to their ideas. Since that time, under her leadership, Samraksha has been a pioneer in all fields related to HIV/AIDS. They have respite homes, the first care centers, the first counseling services, and not just in urban 7 million population Bangalore, but in the hardest to reach villages in the state of Karnataka. Even that wasn't enough. She wanted to change policy at the government level. 10 of their programs that she pioneered are now government policy and funded by the government. They take care of 20,000 odd people today in over 1,000 villages around Karnataka. She works with people like Murali Krishna. Murali Krishna comes from one of those villages. He lost his wife to AIDS a couple of years ago, and he's HIV positive. But he saw the work the care, the compassion that Sangharmitra and her team brought to the village, and he wanted to be part of it. He's a Leaders Quest fellow, and that helps him with his work. They've pioneered a different approach to villages. Instead of handing out information and pamphlets, as is so often the case, they bring theater troupes, songs, music, dance, and they sit around and they talk about dreams. Sangharmitra told me just last week she had just come back from 2 weeks in the villages, and she had a real breakthrough. They were sitting in a circle talking about the dreams for the village. And the young women in the village spoke up and said, "We've changed our dream. Our dream is for our partners, our husbands, not to be given to us because of a horoscope, but to be given to us because they've been tested for HIV. If you were lucky enough to meet Sangharmitra and ask her why and how have you achieved so much? She would look at you and very quietly, very softly say, "It just happened. It's the spirit inside." This is Dr. Fan Jianchuan. Jianchuan comes from Sichuan province in southwest China. He was born in 1957, and you can imagine what his childhood looked like and felt like, and what his life has been like over the last 50 tumultuous years. He's been a soldier, a teacher, a politician, a vice mayor, and a businessman. But if you sat down and asked him, "Who are you really, and what do you do?" he would tell you, "I'm a collector, and I curate a museum." I was lucky. I had heard about him for years, and I finally met him earlier this year at his museum in Chengdu. He's been a collector all of his life, starting when he was 4 or 5 in the early 1960s. Now, just think of the early 1960s in China. Over a lifetime, through everything, through the Cultural Revolution and everything afterwards, he's kept collecting, so that he now has over 8 million pieces in his museums documenting contemporary Chinese history. These are pieces that you won't find anywhere else in the world, in part because they document parts of history Chinese choose to forget. For example, he's got over 1 million pieces documenting the Sino-Japanese War, a war that's not talked about in China very much, and whose heroes are not honored. Why did he do all this? Because he thought a nation should never repeat the mistakes of the past. So, from commissioning slightly larger than life bronze statues of the heroes of the Sino-Japanese War, including those Chinese who then fought with each other and left mainland China to go to Taiwan, to commemorating all the unknown ordinary soldiers who survived by asking them to take prints of their hands, he is making sure, one man is making sure, that history is not forgotten. But it's not just Chinese heroes he cares about. This building contains the world's largest collection of documents and artifacts commemorating the U.S. role in fighting on the Chinese side in that long war, the Flying Tigers. He has 9 other buildings that are already open to the public, filled to the rafters with artifacts documenting contemporary Chinese history. 2 of the most sensitive buildings include a lifetime of collection about the Cultural Revolution, a period that actually most Chinese would prefer to forget. But he doesn't want his nation ever to forget. These people inspire me, and they inspire me because they show us what is possible when you change the way you look at the world, change the way you look at your place in the world. They looked outside, and then they changed what was on the inside. They didn't go to business school. They didn't read a manual, how to be a good leader in 10 easy steps. But they have qualities we'd all recognize. They have drive, passion, commitment. They've gone away from what they did before, and they've gone to something they didn't know. They've tried to connect worlds they didn't know existed before. They've built bridges, and they've walked across them. They have a sense of the great arc of time and their tiny place in it. They know people have come before them and will follow them. And they know that they're part of a whole, that they depend on other people. It's not about them. They know that. But it has to start with them. And they have humility. It just happens. But we know it doesn't just happen, don't we? We know it takes a lot to make it happen. And we know the direction the world is going in. So I think we need succession planning on a global basis. We can't wait for the next generation, the new joiners, to come in and learn how to be the good leaders we need. I think it has to start with us. And we know, just like they knew, how hard it is. But the good news is that we don't have to figure it out as we go along. We have models. We have examples, like Benki and Sanghamitra and John Chuan. We can look at what they've done. If we look, we can learn from what they've learned. We can change the way we see ourselves in the world. And if we're lucky, we can change the way our great-grandchildren will answer Benki's question. Thank you.
That was Fields Wicker Murin, recorded at TED in September of 2009. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4.
So many people calling me, so many things to do. I could let it all bother me, but instead I choose to follow through. 'Cause things once were hard for me and seemed too tough to bear. But looking back, now I see when I needed people, they were there. And now I realize that I must strong. And I know it's right for me to share. When you choose to have a giving heart, you'll know it's the right place to start. And good things will come back to you. 'Cause when I gave, somebody gave back to me. I used to help unwillingly till it all made sense to me.
Do the things I would want done for me. And
And that was Rivka with her song, When You Truly Care. This is Parangara, and you are listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. You can listen to a podcast of this program and broadcasts of other artists on this station by going to party934.com and clicking on a podcast page. Leaders need to bring together the people in the organization for essential conversations. Giving everyone a voice in the matter ensures that they feel respected, and storytelling provides the opportunity for everyone to be heard. But how do we as a society fare today in the ability to listen? Julian Treasure is the chair of the Sound Agency, a firm that advises worldwide businesses on how to use sound. He asks us to pay attention to the sounds that surround us. Treasure is the author of the book Sound Business, and keeps a blog by the same name that ruminates on oral matters. His most recent book, entitled How to Be Heard, Secrets for Powerful Speaking and Listening, offers an inspiring vision for a sonorous world of effective speaking, listening, and understanding. He says that in our louder and louder world, we seem to be losing our listening. In this short, fascinating talk, he shares 5 ways to retune your ears for conscious listening. To other people and to the world around you. Let's listen to Julian Treasure.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference. This episode features sound expert Julian Treasure. Here's Julian Treasure.
We are losing our listening. We spend roughly 60% of our communication time listening, but we're not very good at it. We retain just 25% of what we hear. Now, not you, not this talk, but that is generally true. Let's define listening as making meaning from sound. It's a mental process, and it's a process of extraction. We use some pretty cool techniques to do this. One of them is pattern recognition. So in a cocktail party like this, if I say, David, Sarah, pay attention, some of you just sat up. We recognize patterns to distinguish noise from signal, and especially our name. Differencing is another technique we use. If I left this pink noise on for more than a couple of minutes, you would literally cease to hear it. We listen to differences, we discount sounds that remain the same. And then there is a whole range of filters. These filters take us from all sound down to what we pay attention to. Most people are entirely unconscious of these filters, but they actually create our reality in a way because they tell us what we're paying attention to right now. I'll give you one example of that. Intention is very important in sound, in listening. When I married my wife, I promised her that I would listen to her every day as if for the first time. Now, that's something I fall short of on a daily basis. But it's a great intention to have in a relationship. But that's not all. Sound places us in space and in time. If you close your eyes right now in this room, you're aware of the size of the room from the reverberation and the bouncing of the sound off the surfaces. And you're aware of how many people are around you because of the micro noises you're receiving. And sound places us in time as well, because sound always has time embedded in it. In fact, I would suggest that our listening is the main way that we experience the flow of time from past to future. So, sonority is time and meaning, a great quote. I said at the beginning, we're losing our listening. Why did I say that? Well, there are a lot of reasons for this. First of all, we invented ways of recording. First, writing, then audio recording, and now video recording as well. The premium on accurate and careful listening has simply disappeared. Secondly, the world is now so noisy, with this cacophony going on visually and auditorily, it's just hard to listen. It's tiring to listen. Many people take refuge in headphones, but they turn big public spaces like this, shared soundscapes, into millions of tiny little personal sound bubbles. In this scenario, nobody's listening to anybody. We're becoming impatient. We don't want oratory anymore, we want sound bites. And the art of conversation is being replaced, dangerously, I think, by personal broadcasting. I don't know how much listening there is in this conversation, which is sadly very common, especially in the UK. We're becoming desensitized. Our media have to scream at us with these kind of headlines in order to get our attention. And that means it's harder for us to pay attention to the quiet, the subtle, the understated. This is a serious problem that we're losing our listening. This is not trivial. Because listening is our access to understanding. Conscious listening always creates understanding. And only without conscious listening can these things happen. A world where we don't listen to each other at all is a very scary place indeed. So I'd like to share with you 5 simple exercises, tools you can take away with you to improve your own conscious listening. Would you like that?
Yes.
Good. The first one is silence. Just 3 minutes a day of silence is a wonderful exercise to reset your ears and to recalibrate so that you can hear the quiet again. If you can't get absolute silence, go for quiet. That's absolutely fine. Second, I call this the mixer. So even if you're in a noisy environment like this, and we all spend a lot of time in places like this, listen in the coffee bar to how many channels of sound can I hear? How many individual channels in that mix am I listening to? You can do it in a beautiful place as well, like a lake. How many birds am I hearing? Where are they? Where are those ripples? It's a great exercise for improving the quality of your listening. Third, this exercise I call savoring, and this is a beautiful exercise. It's about enjoying mundane sounds. This, for example, is my tumble dryer. It's a waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I love it. Or just try this one on for size. Wow. So mundane sounds can be really interesting if you pay attention. I call that the hidden choir. It's around us all the time. The next exercise is probably the most important of all of these. If you just take one thing away, this is listening positions. The idea that you can move your listening position to what's appropriate to what you're listening to. This is playing with those filters. You remember I gave you those filters at the beginning? It's starting to play with them as levers to get conscious about them and to move to different places. These are just some of the listening positions or scales of listening positions that you can use. There are many. Have fun with that. It's very exciting. And finally, an acronym. You can use this in listening in communication if you're in any one of those roles, and I think that probably is everybody who's listening to this talk. The acronym is RASA, which is the Sanskrit word for juice or essence. And RASA stands for receive, which means pay attention to the person, appreciate, making little noises like, oh, okay. Summarize, the word so is very important in communication. And ask questions afterwards. Now, sound is my passion, it's my life. I wrote a whole book about it, so I live to listen. That's too much to ask for most people. But I believe that every human being needs to listen consciously in order to live fully, connected in space and in time to the physical world around us, connected in understanding to each other, not to mention spiritually connected, because every spiritual path I know of has listening and contemplation at its heart. That's why we need to teach listening in our schools as a skill. Why is it not taught? It's crazy. And if we can teach listening in our schools, we can take our listening off that slippery slope to that dangerous, scary world that I talked about and move it to a place where everybody is consciously listening all the time, or at least capable of doing it. Now, I don't know how to do that, but this is TED. And I think the TED community is capable of anything. So I invite you to connect with me, connect with each other, take this mission out, and let's get listening taught in schools and transform the world in one generation to a conscious listening world, a world of connection, a world of understanding, and a world of peace. Thank you for listening to me today.
That was Julian Treasure, recorded at TED in July of 2011. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Stay tuned for Uber Jazz at 3 p.m. Eastern and more non-traditional independent programming. Party 93.4 is a project of the Free From Radio Initiative, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide diverse and innovative online broadcasting that reflects the interests and concerns of the community. If you like the program you've been listening to, please consider supporting the Freeform Radio Initiative by making a tax-deductible donation. You can go to the website at freeformradio.org or party934.com and click on the donate button. Thanks in advance for your support. I would also like to invite you to sign up for the e-newsletter. It's a simple way to show your support and a great way to keep tabs on the Freeform Radio Initiative. You can sign up by going to party934.com and fill in the entry field with your email address. It's that simple. This is Parangara, your mixologist for Bricata Circle and storytelling for nonprofits. Thank you once again for listening. Till next time, discover how telling your story could spark another story from someone across the table or perhaps across the globe, so you can make meaningful connections, foster understanding, and bring about real change in people's lives. Have a great week.